Today on Maine Calling, James Blaine of Maine. Maine's governor lives in the Blaine House. You probably knew that. Did you know that there's another Blaine House, even bigger and fancier, in Washington, D.C.? And what do you know about James Blaine, the man the houses are named for? Well, if you lived in the U.S. during the 19th century Gilded Age, you knew about James Blaine. He was one of the most important politicians in the nation. Charismatic, controversial, and the Republican nominee for president in 1884. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we step back in time to another tumultuous period in American politics and learn about the role James Blaine played back then. A new book highlights Blaine's role in one of the biggest scandals of his day. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. You've heard of the Blaine House, but do you know who James Blaine was? Well, the influential politician from Maine was a major national figure during the Gilded Age, the late 19th century. We'll hear about why he was so prominent and how his career holds certain parallels to today. Joining us for the hour, Robert Mitchell. His new book is The Partisans: James G. Blaine, Roscoe Conkling, and the Politics of Rivalry and Revenge in the Gilded Age. That comes out just today. He's a journalist who has worked for decades with the Washington Post News Service. Also with us is Earl Shuttleworth, who is the longtime Maine State historian and is the author of a book about the Blaine House. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about James Blaine? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. So before we turn to this topic, talking about James Blaine, we are going to talk about current events. And here to talk with us about the news of the government shutdown, my colleague Steve Missler, who is Maine Public Radio's chief politics and government correspondent. Thanks so much for joining us, Steve.
My pleasure.
How did we get here?
Well, Jen, this is basically the result of the Democrats in Congress trying to prevent a series of cuts to healthcare programs, primarily subsidies enacted during the pandemic for people who buy insurance via the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Those subsidies are expected to expire at the end of the year. So Democrats want to reauthorize them now as part of a bill to keep the government funded. Republicans are balking at this, and they've tried to move a stopgap funding bill to keep the government open through at least mid-November. But this is also sort of is part of a larger fight between the parties. I mean, Democrats are facing a lot of pressure not to give in to Republicans or even make deals with them. And that's because the GOP has gone back against funding deals after the Trump administration clawed back spending in previous appropriations bills. That's actually how they passed the cuts to public broadcasting. There's also pressure on Democratic leaders to do more to fight the Trump administration. And spending bills are one of the very few ways that they can do that right now, given that they're out of power in both the House and the Senate.
So there was a very late vote in the Senate, and both King and Collins voted with the Republicans. Not a surprise that Senator Collins voted with the Republicans, but Steve, tell us about Senator King's vote.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise because on a previous vote, Senator King had actually voted against this stopgap funding measure. But his rationale last night should sound familiar because it sounds a little bit like Senator Collins, and also Jared Golden in the 2nd Congressional District, and also a Democrat who had made a similar rationale last week on a very similar set of votes. And what Senator King is basically arguing is that, look, I understand that there's a desire to push back against the Trump administration. But he was more worried that this would empower the Trump administration to make a bunch of cuts that he might not otherwise be able to do without a shutdown. And that's because when the government shuts down, that gives a lot of authority to the executive branch to determine how that shutdown, what that shutdown will look like. Who are essential workers? Who are people who could be furloughed or even fired? And so I think Senator King just was uncomfortable with using this particular issue or this particular bill as to make a stand against the Trump administration. Senator Collins has said something very similar in the past, and Jared Golden has as well. Democrat Shelley Pingree, however, is basically standing alongside most of the Democratic House members and also most of the Democrats in the Senate as well.
All right. What do we know about the impacts of the shutdown here in Maine?
Well, that's to be determined. I mean, I think in the past, we have 12,000 federal workers in the state. And in the past, those federal workers were furloughed. Those working in essential, like agencies that have, jobs that are deemed essential, like air traffic controllers, border control, or the postal service, would continue to work during a shutdown and work without pay. You know, this also the Acadia National Park could probably shut down and the workers there could be furloughed. But it's also unclear if the Trump administration will keep the park open to visitors as it did during the last shutdown, which was between 2018 and 2019. And that actually caused a lot of problems from the Park Service, not just in Acadia, but across the country, because there was nobody to pick up trash or just to make sure, maintain trails and that sort of thing. And so there was an outcry after those parks were left open and there was no staff to take care of the crowds and the trash and everything else. The other services should continue, but there may be disruptions. Recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will continue to receive their benefits, but some of the services may be limited depending on the duration of a shutdown. So if you're a new applicant to those programs, you're probably not going to be able to get an application process during the shutdown. The more imminent threat, I would say, is to mothers and young children who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. It's otherwise known as WIC, and it's a food program. Those folks may feel the effects a lot sooner if states don't step in to provide additional funding. And that's just because of the way that program is funded. It's a reappropriation is supposed to start, I believe, on October 1st. And so it's effectively out of money. There's a multitude of other effects that could be, that could happen here. But another issue is that the Trump administration has not communicated with states, or at least Maine, about who will be affected, who will be furloughed, who will be deemed essential, and who will be not deemed that way. So the Governor Janet Mills was complaining about that yesterday. And so there's still a fair amount of uncertainty. And that doesn't even include how we get out of this thing, because both sides seem to be very, very much dug in.
Yeah, both sides are dug in. You mentioned depends on the duration of this thing. We look back in history and we see that some government shutdowns have been very brief and some have been quite extended. I understand Congress isn't even in Washington right now.
That's right. And so they're not, they're not really talking. And, to the extent that they were talking before, it wasn't very effective. So, it's just really unclear what the path out of this is. But like I mentioned earlier, I think Democrats are under a lot of pressure not to cave. It's just unclear, how much pain they're willing to accept, because shutdowns, they do cause pain. And they cause pain to constituents who could start making a lot of noise and making things difficult for, while the government is shut down. And I think it's also worth noting that shutting down the government to extract policy concessions is very rarely successful. And you can ask a lot of the Republicans who have forced shutdowns in the past, including over the Affordable Care Act.
Mm. Steve, is there anything before we let you go you'd like to say about this moment in history and in the partisan politics?
I mean, I think the only thing you could say is it's just, it's just a deepening of these tensions and animosity, which have been very acute this year in particular, but certainly in years past. And, you know, I just think there's just a lot of distrust between the parties. And I don't know how you solve that over a funding bill and during a government shutdown, but it's certainly not great for the American people.
Steve Missler, thank you so much for taking some time. Steve Missler, Maine Public Radio's chief politics and government correspondent. Now we will turn to our panelists for today's conversation about 19th century politician James Blaine. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us for this hour. And I'm going to start with you, Bob, because part of the reason we're doing this show about James Blaine today is because you have written a book about a pivotal period in his career. That book is being released today. Congratulations. And tell us, why did you pick Blaine to write about?
Well, first of all, Jennifer, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's quite an honor. I have been fascinated with the Gilded Age for many years, and anybody who spends any time in that period inevitably comes across James Gillespie Blaine. He was really one of the most significant politicians of the decades after the Civil War. And, you know, three terms as House Speaker, three-time presidential candidate, served three different presidents as Secretary of State, the author of a very, very good book about the political history of the United States up through 1880, and in many ways, I think, a forerunner of the modern politician with his particular assets as a political figure. He was a gifted extemporaneous speaker. He had a photographic memory that enabled him to cultivate a wide range of people who regarded him as a friend because he could remember their encounters years after they occurred and ask them detailed questions about their community and other particulars. He was charismatic also, I think importantly, his experience in Maine before he got into politics as a newspaperman equipped him, trained him to be cognizant of and able to respond to currents in public opinion. He was really quick on his feet when it came to that, and sometimes very effectively. One of the things that's interesting about the story of Blaine and Conkling really is that it was a rivalry between two different styles of politics, and one of them, Blaine, I think, was the guy who pointed to the future of American politics, and Conkling was a sort of a figure from the past.
Mm. We'll turn to you, Earl Shuttleworth. Robert's book, Bob's book, focuses on a later period in James Blaine's career. Take us back to the beginning. I understand he was not born in Maine, even though he became the most influential politician from Maine.
No, he was actually born in Pennsylvania, and he trained to be a teacher, and that's where he met his wife. She was teaching in the same institution out of state, but she was from Augusta, Maine, and she was from a prominent family in Augusta, Maine. And so in 1853, the Blaines returned to Augusta, and it was at that point, as Bob has mentioned, he had an early career in the newspapers. He became a co-editor and at one point briefly owner of the Kennebec Journal, which of course is a newspaper still very much with us today. And so that's really what gave him his start in Maine politics. And so from 1853 until the election of 1858, he was in the newspapers. And then in 58, he ran for the legislature. And to show how quickly he moved up in the political sphere, and of course, he adopted the newly birthed Republican Party. But in 58, he was elected to the legislature. And within a very short time, he was Speaker of the House of the Maine Legislature. And then in 1862, he ran for the Congress. And that really began his national career. 1862 was also a very important year for the Blaines in that James G. Blaine bought what we now know as the Blaine House, which had been built in 1833 by a retired sea captain, James Hall from Bath. Wonderful location right across from the newly completed Maine State House on the corner of State and Capitol Streets. Cost $5,000 and was kind of a present to his wife. And that house became, for the next 30 years, the center of his political career in Maine. The Blaines were great entertainers from a political standpoint. Presidents visited them there, political leaders, and local and state leaders as well.
All right. Well, in just a little while, Earl, I want to have you talk about a little bit more about the Blaine House. But I want to go back to you, Bob, and ask you, Earl sort of touched on this a little bit about how quickly he rose. I understand James Blaine was elected to Congress when he was 33 years old. He'd already been the editor of a newspaper and had various positions in the Maine legislature by then.
Yes, his rise, his political rise was meteoric and reflected his talents as a politician. The contemporaneous observations of journalists and political figures from that day all point to the fact that he had this ability to win people over to his side. There's a great quote from former Maine Governor Kent, which I'm going to struggle to dig up here, but it was about Blaine's ability to connect with people in his adopted state. And maybe Earl can help me with the exact quote here, because for a variety of reasons, I'm not able to come up with it now. But essentially, Governor Kent said he had Western dash and was able to win over the Downeasters with his charisma, and the same principle worked in his favor in the House. Blaine, over the years, attracted a number of nicknames. Many of them were not complimentary, I will point out. But one that was bestowed on him by none other than Thaddeus Stevens, who came out on the short end of a debate about whether to pay Civil War bonds in gold or gold-backed dollars or with other kinds of currency. Blaine won that day by insisting on payment in the gold-backed currency. And Blaine attributed his legislative victory to his magnetic personality. And from thenceforth, one of Blaine's nicknames was the Magnetic Man. So that had a lot to do with Blaine's rise within the corridors of power.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. And Earl Shuttleworth, I understand that we're going to see if you can try to call in on a telephone because your connection isn't so great on the Zoom right now.
Oh,
but we are talking about James Blaine. Yes, the Blaine House's name for James Blaine. He was also one of the most important people in the 19th century in the country, even though so many people don't know about him today. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about James Blaine. Why was he such a significant national political figure in the 19th century? Our guest, Earl Shuttleworth, state historian and author of a book about the Blaine House, and Bob Mitchell, longtime journalist with the Washington Post News Service and author of the new book, The Partisans, James G. Blaine, Roscoe Conkling, and the Politics of Rivalry and Revenge in the Gilded Age. Share your comments and questions. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Bob, in just a minute, I want to ask you about the specific scandal you've written a book about. But I also, more broadly, want to find out about James Blaine and what he believed in. I understand one of his big issues was tariffs.
That's right, Jennifer. James Blaine, like a lot of Republicans, like most Republicans, in fact, after the Civil War, supported tariffs, protective tariffs, to foster domestic industry and protect wages. That was a mainstay of Republican thinking and indeed Whig thinking going back in the years before the Civil War. But what Blaine did was in 1880, he began to detect that the issues of the Civil War, survival, the protection of the Union, the saving of the Union, the emancipation of enslaved peoples, and the political complications and difficulties that arose from that, were losing their resonance among Northern voters. It took a particularly sharp turn after the stock market crash of 1874 that set in motion a economic depression that lasted through much of the rest of the decade. In 1880, in those days, as many of us know, Maine's state elections were held in September and were regarded as bellwethers for the rest of the country. And in 1880, Democrat and a fusion candidate of the Democrats and the Greenback Party posted a surprise victory in the gubernatorial race. Shortly thereafter, Blaine burst into the offices of the Republican National Committee and urged them to lay away the bloody shirt, paraphrasing exactly what he said. But his point was, it's time for us to emphasize tariffs. Protection. The Democrats have allied themselves with free trade, and that's a foolish position. We can win on tariffs. And much of the Garfield campaign was conducted on that basis, and they did win. And from that moment, Blaine became a leading advocate of making protection, as he called it, the keystone of Republican appeals to the electorate. And in that way, this was before William McKinley, who is often associated with tariffs and associated with tariffs by the current president. Blaine was really the first advocate of that kind of position, making tariffs the focus, the primary basis of Republicans' appeals to the electorate. So, yeah, he was a very passionate on that, and that became a characteristic of his late political career.
Earl Shuttleworth, we've talked about Blaine being part of the young Republican Party at the time. I understand when he was editor of the Kennebec Journal was considered a Whig newspaper. Can you put that in context today? What would it mean to be a Whig versus a Republican?
I'm actually going to punt that to Bob. Bob, do you have an answer for that?
That's an interesting question, Jennifer and Earl. I think that the Republican Party in the 1850s emerged from Northern Whigs and anti-slavery Democrats who united on their opposition to the spread of enslavement into Western territories. Because they were the opposition party to the Democrats, in many ways, Whigs, I think, can be regarded as the real antecedents of the modern Republican Party. And Blaine was a Whig in his youth, and his father was a Whig. They both idolized Henry Clay, the Kentucky Whig, who, among other things, advocated an economic program that he called the American system, that in which tariffs figured prominently, but also government support for railroad construction and public improvements that would facilitate easier transportation of products across American markets. And Blaine idolized Clay and embraced those views and internalized them and made them part of his political outlook. And the Whig approach was really central to understanding Blaine's political evolution.
All right. I'll turn to you, Earl, and want to talk a little bit about the Blaine House. How did it come to be the governor's mansion in Maine?
Well, James G. Blaine died in 1893, and the house was inherited by his wife, who then died in 1903. And then it was then inherited by various members of his family, and ultimately, around 1917, became the property of his grandson, Walker Blaine Beale. Walker Blaine Beale was a young man who was at Harvard when he enlisted in the Army for World War I. And very sadly, toward the end of the war, in the San Miguel Drive, he was killed. And so his mother, Harriet Blaine Beale, then inherited the house as part of his estate. And within a year after the grandson's death, she offered it to the state of Maine. The state of Maine had never had an official governor's mansion. And in fact, governors who did not live in Augusta were forced often to live in boarding houses or to rent houses for their families and themselves. And so Governor Milliken, Carl Milliken, and the state legislature very much welcomed this offer of a gift of a mansion, which was so properly located right across the street from the state house, so handy, and at the same time had such history attached to it, and also was a very beautiful building. The Blaines had done some Victorian features to the building, exterior and interior, but it still had a lot of its earlier character from the federal period as well. And in 1919, Carl Milliken, in order to get the house ready to be the official governor and family residence, hired John Calvin Stevens, who was the leading architect in the state from Portland, to renovate the house, to do some remodeling. And the Blaine House is very much today as it was 100 years ago when the Millikens were the first family to move in.
Hmm. Okay, Bob, it's time. Tell us what you wrote the book about. Tell us about the great rivalry between James G. Blaine and Roscoe Conkling, two names almost lost to history. But if we were alive in the 1800s, this would be what we would be following, right?
Exactly, exactly. These were, after Lincoln and Grant, these were the two biggest names in the Republican Party in the 1870s. And I'm going to have to open the book here to quote, to do justice to the quote that I'm going to read here. But in 1866, Roscoe Conkling and Blaine were both backbench members of the House of Representatives. And Conkling was campaigning for the abolition of the Provost Marshal's Bureau, which ran and often mismanaged the draft during the Civil War. He and also attacked the general who led it. Blaine rose to the defense of the general, and Conkling and Blaine had an impassioned exchange on the House floor, and that resumed a week later. And when Conkling expressed contempt for Blaine's involvement in this debate, Blaine unloaded with this statement: "The contempt of that large-minded gentleman is so wilting. His haughty disdain, his grandiloquent swell, his majestic, supereminent, overpowering turkey gobbler strut has been so crushing to myself and to all members of this House that I know it was an act of the greatest temerity to venture upon a controversy with him." He went on to note that that Conkling had been favorably compared to a radical Republican congressman who had recently passed away, and Blaine said this comparison added additional pomposity to Blaine or Conkling's strut, and then concluded this way: "Hyperion to a satyr, Thersites to Hercules, mud to marble, dunghill to diamond, a singed cat to a Bengal tiger, a whining puppy to a roaring lion." He eviscerated Conkling, who was a rather belligerent and vain figure, and Conkling never forgot it and dedicated much of the rest of his political career to foiling Blaine at every turn. They were rivals for the Republican presidential nomination in 1876 that went to Rutherford B. Hayes. In 1880, Conkling led the effort to nominate Ulysses S. Grant for a third term. Blaine was running again. They dueled to a draw over 35 ballots before James A. Garfield became the party's nominee on the 36th ballot. In 1884, when Blaine finally did get the Republican nomination, Conkling, by this time out of politics, sat out the election. And Blaine narrowly lost New York. There were a lot of reasons for that, but one of them was that the remaining Conkling loyalists sat the election out too, or indeed actually worked for Cleveland. So this rivalry really had enormous impact on the Republican Party in the 1870s and into the mid-1880s. Blaine remained an enormously popular figure and received votes for the party's presidential nomination as late as 1892. He was in ill health at that time and died the following year, but that is a testament to his lingering hold on the Republican rank and file. So, yeah, that in a nutshell, that's the story.
And you know, this whole, I think so many people haven't even heard about this and didn't even know there was a specific agency that oversaw the draft and that there were charges of corruption. But these charges of corruption, no matter what Blaine did, haunted him, right?
Right. Blaine had a reputation, perhaps unjust, perhaps just, for using his position of power for self-enrichment. This first came up in 1871 when a Democratic newspaper in Maine, the Maine Standard, accused him of leveraging his clout to afford what they described as his princely home on 15th Street north of the White House. Blaine denied that, but what he did not report was that he had received a $30,000 loan from the financial house of Jay Cook, and then promised in a letter to use his offices to help out Cook in any way he could. More damningly, and unfortunately more complicated story involves Blaine's relationship with the Little Rock and Fort Smith Railroad. He came to its aid in 1869 when it looked like its efforts to get needed federal land were going to be sidetracked, and the railroad's financial backers, out of gratitude, commissioned him to sell railroad bonds, which he would get a commission on. And then Blaine asked for a gratuity of additional bonds, $160,000 worth. All of this came to light in 1876 when congressional Democrats were investigating Blaine's financial dealings and came across a Boston bookkeeper who had the correspondence between Blaine and the and one of the financiers of the railroad. Blaine met with the gentleman who had the letters and then seized control of them. He took them from the guy and refused to give them back. This created an enormous firestorm of controversy, and although Blaine had worked hard to cultivate friends in the press, not even his those efforts saved him from the avalanche of negative headlines. So Blaine took to the floor of the House in June of 1876 with the letters in hand, defended his seizure of them, and defended his right to keep them private, and then read them selectively to demonstrate his innocence. It was a dramatic performance, and at the conclusion, the House erupted in cheers. Some people likened the reaction in the House chamber to the reaction that occurred following the passage of the 13th Amendment. That's how dramatic this moment was. He won the day in the House, but he never really shook the sense that he was in it for himself. And that was a problem that dogged him through the rest of his career.
All right. Well, we are talking about James G. Blaine on Maine Calling. Earl Shuttleworth, go ahead.
I just want to add that because of this reputation of reputed corruption, one of the slurs that was frequently used against him was Blaine Blaine, the continental liar from the state of Maine. And the cartoonists of the day had a field day with it, a famous cartoon called The Tattooed Man, in which Blaine is standing in the well of the Senate, all of the, the senators are in their Roman togas, and he is basically stripped of his clothing, and all the tattoos are the various slurs against him. It's quite a graphic.
Yeah, and Bob, you're saying maybe deserved, maybe not deserved. We don't know.
Huh. I think he did deserve some of it. To Earl's point about the cartoons, he did become a figure. There was a change in political cartooning occurring at about this time, the sort of civilized gray renderings of Thomas Nast with his quotations from, you know, Rome classical literature and stuff were still being published in Harper's, but the cartoon that Earl is referring to appeared in Puck, which was a weekly humor magazine printed in color, and these images were vivid and really powerful. I mean, they also made classical allusions, but you didn't have to be acquainted with the classics to appreciate the humor of the caricatures. And Blaine was for Puck what Richard Nixon was for Herblock, I think. And the Tattooed Man is really vivid, and once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. It's quite an image. But you know, that gets to a larger point, if I may. I mean, people think that the press is partisan and unhinged in the 21st century. This is what we see today is child's play compared to the raucous and over the top headlines, editorials, rhetoric, and cartoons of the 19th century. It was in many ways as hostile, if not more hostile, media environment than what our political figures face today.
Well, we are talking about. Go ahead, Earl Shuttleworth.
Yeah, I just want to add that in fairness and in balance, you know, many people accused Blaine of ill-gotten get wealth, but he also made a huge amount of money on his own through his publications, particularly the two-volume 20 Years in Congress, which was sold extensively across the country and brought him in a small fortune.
All right. Well, we're talking about James G. Blaine, the Maine statesman for whom our governor's mansion is named. That's where he lived when he was in Maine, when he was not living in the other Blaine house in Washington, D.C. What are your questions about the late 1800s in Maine? What are your questions about James Blaine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're learning about the charismatic politician James Blaine, his life and legacy. Joining us, Bob Mitchell, who has a new book out today about Blaine called The Partisans. Mitchell was formerly with the Washington Post. And Earl Shuttleworth is with us as well. He's author of the book The Blaine House, and he is, of course, Maine State historian. Join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Earl, Jay was on the phone for a while but had to drop, but we know he wanted to ask this. What was James Blaine's relationship with another Mainer, Vice President Hannibal Hamlin, if any?
Oh, they would have known each other very well. Let's put it into context. Hamlin was elected governor just at the time that Blaine was coming into political life to serve in the legislature, although Hamlin served only very briefly, and then he was appointed to go to the Senate. And then quickly after that, in Chicago in 1860, he was nominated to be vice president, Lincoln's vice president, and of course was elected. And so Hamlin would have been serving as vice president in Washington from 1861 to 1865. And then after his service as vice president, he continued on as a U.S. senator representing Maine until the early 1880s. The two were very close contemporaries, both powerhouses in the early Republican Party in Maine, and would have, I think, worked closely together, known each other very well.
We're going to go to Nick, who's calling from Waterford. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Good morning. So the question is, I'm originally from Roosick County, where the town of Blaine is near Mars Hill. Was the town named after Mr. Blaine, and how did that happen, and did he ever visit the town of Blaine?
Good question. I believe it was named for him. Roosick was largely not settled until after the Civil War, and the town of Blaine, I would have to look it up exactly when it was incorporated, but it would be from that immediate post-Civil War era, and Blaine, of course, had already risen to political prominence in Maine and in the nation, so it would make sense that it was named after him. But I don't know whether he ever visited there, but I'm pretty sure that it bears his name.
Another caller who we lost wanted you all to talk about the granite scandal that Blaine was involved with. The caller, Peter, was at an island off the coast of Thomaston and read about Blaine's role in making granite succeed in Maine, but apparently there was corruption involved. Earl.
Yes, well, in the post-Civil War period, granite became a major industry in Maine. And most of the granite was coming from the offshore islands, like Vinyl Haven, Hurricane Island, Dix Island, but also Hollowell was another major source. And a lot of this granite was actually going to huge government projects. After the Civil War, there was a big building program to build post offices, custom houses, the executive office building, and so on. And so as a result, Blaine, being in Washington and holding the positions he did, he was very close to a number of the granite quarry owners in advocating that Maine granite be purchased for these big government projects. And again, there was the question of whether he might have benefited from this relationship.
Hmm. Robert, I want to ask you sort of the broader question. We're having this conversation on the day of a government shutdown. There are ugly partisan politics underway. There are people who have big charismatic personalities in Washington. What are some of the similarities between James Blaine and James Blaine's day and today? And what are some of the important differences?
Oh, that is a big picture question for sure. Where to begin? We've already talked about the media. It was highly partisan, over the top, and bears some relationships to the sort of the modern 21st century internet culture that politicians have to navigate today. I think that one important difference, might be that Blaine and Conkling were both committed to working within the system. They did not, neither one of them at critical moments in the 1870s, both of them worked in different ways and in different situations to diffuse situations that threatened to end in violence. Conkling in 1877 worked for the passage of the Electoral Commission that essentially made it possible for Congress to vote on disputed election returns and choose and recognize Rutherford B. Hayes as the president. In 1879, when there was a disputed election in Maine, Blaine, working out of the Blaine House, coordinated the Republican response to efforts by Democrats and their greenback allies to prevent the election of the Republican candidate for governor. That crisis ended when, at a critical moment, Joshua Chamberlain emerged from the State House and dared the Democratic and Greenback militias that had gravitated around the State House to shoot at him. And somebody said, anybody who shoots at him, I'm going to shoot them right back. Blaine deferred to Chamberlain, and the crisis was ultimately solved. So in one very important way, both Blaine and Conkling, while they were partisan, extremely partisan and extremely serious about the pursuit of power, worked within the system and recognized that the rule of law and the peaceful transfer of power was an essential part of the American democratic system. So I guess that would be one significant difference. And then I think that may be the most important one, actually.
All right. I'm going to go to an email here from Maggie. Renovations on the Blaine House are happening now. How often was it renovated, and do those renovations reflect and are in historic shape to the original house? Earl, what do we know about the current renovations on the Blaine House?
Yes. The current renovation consists of the creation of a new fence around the property. The fence that has been replaced just recently is a fence that was put up during the 1919 or 1920 renovations of the house. It was a wooden fence, a low fence, and one that in recent years has caused literally annual renovation because of its deteriorating condition. Back around 2018, when Governor Page was still in office, he brought up the question of a new fence, both from the standpoint of just the practicality of constantly having to repair the old one, but also recognizing the realities of modern security. And so after many studies and much work by the state, the decision was made to go ahead and take down the old fence and put up a new one, which I think will be very handsome. It's based on the fence around the State House. It has an actual granite base to it, and then the wrought iron fence above. And looking at the renderings of it, I have, because I'm the chairman of the Blaine House Commission, responsible for any changes to the house, I feel that we've made a good decision and a long-term investment. That fence will probably serve the state for at least another 100 years, like the old wooden one did for a century.
Well, thank you for that question, Maggie. Robert, we have just about a minute left, and I'm wondering what you hope that a contemporary reader takes away from this story about James G. Blaine and Roscoe Conkling. Why is that story important today?
Well, because I think the Gilded Age is a relevant period in American history. It's being rediscovered. We know this from the various media productions, things that have been on TV and streaming services. And I think that people are understanding that there are lessons to be learned about our current politics from the way politicians navigated similar challenges in the 1870s and 1880s. Radical changes in the economy, racial tensions, nativism, widening gaps between the wealthy and the middle class and the poor. These are all these are all live issues today, and how Blaine and Conkling each confronted them has much to tell us about the way we are confronting them today.
Well, thank you both for joining us for the hour. Unfortunately, we're out of time. That was Bob Mitchell, a veteran journalist with the Washington Post News Service and author of the new book, The Partisans, James G. Blaine, Roscoe Conkling, and the Politics of Rivalry and Revenge in the Gilded Age. Also with us for the hour, Earl Shuttleworth, Maine state historian and author of a book about the Blaine House. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, AI in Everyday Life. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.